The haha. We have to put some limits on it, or we'll be doing this all week.
So you're going to sit in here, nice and dry?
Noel said.
No, darling. I'm a good sport. I'll use the folly by the pond as a base, and we'll make it a rule. Once anyone leaves the main house, there's no going back in until the game is over.
We get torches, don't we? Suze asked.
Torches are for seekers,
Peter said. That's always been the rule.
Correct, Sebastian replied.
Last person to be found is the winner.
Where is Rosie? It's time to start.
Having a slash, Suze said. She's coming.
Sure enough, there was the sound of rapid footfall down the stairs, and Rosie appeared at the door, looking a bit distracted.
Right, Sebastian said. Now we can start. The count begins. One, two, three.
The group scattered. Theo and Yash remained inside, but the others all went for the many doors that led to the outside. There were certainly plenty of places to hide inside Merryweather. The house had many bedrooms and reception rooms, multiple all-purpose rooms for washing and household use, box rooms, crawl spaces, closets, a cluttered and rambling attic, and a genuinely cavernous basement. If one ventured outside, there were acres of gardens with tall borders, an orchard, and dozens of dark pockets and nooks between trees and behind buildings. An ambitious player could hide indefinitely. At the count of 100, Sebastian opened his eyes and surveyed the empty sitting room. He listened carefully for the sound of movement overhead. Nothing. The rain beat against the windows, but he heard no creaking footsteps. He smiled and gulped back the remainder of the closest glass of champagne.
"Here I come!"
he shouted. He began in the house, and he found Theo first, which was not a surprise. She was crouching in one of the understairs cupboards. Sebastian and Theo were best friends, so she likely put herself close by to join him. Yash was next, having somewhat half-heartedly pressed himself under the bed in Noel's room. No one else turned up in this first review of the house. The team of seekers was now three. They donned their yellow slickers and stepped out into the rain, which had intensified a good bit. The drops drove themselves into the ground. Visibility was poor, and the rain made a deafening noise as it hit the hoods of the ponchos.
"I'll do a sweep of the front garden and then head to the folly," Sebastian said. "Theo, take the gardens around the orangery and head back round the house. Yash, go from the other side. Start with the tennis courts."
It would be over an hour before the next person was found. This was Angela. Theo found her lurking around the stables. Just before 1 in the morning, Yash found Peter hiding under a bench in the back garden. By this point, the rain had become violent. The ground was saturated, so muddy that it sucked in running feet. The lightning got closer. But the nine continued, running and yelling in their ponchos, flashes of torchlight cutting through the dark. Sebastian held court in the folly, waving a bottle of champagne and drunkenly yelling encouragement over the onslaught of the storm. It was almost 1:30 when Peter caught Suze, who had pressed herself in between some tall hedges along the inner edge of the walled garden. 2 o'clock approached, and three of the nine were still unaccounted for. The search took on a frenzied quality. The searchers taunted the hiders with their calls. They flashed their lights into the shadows, poked under benches with sticks, stood sentry in front of doors and ends of pathways. They tried pincer movements to force them out of hiding. There was one tremendous boom, and the lights in Merryweather went out all at once. Now it was very dark indeed. Yash ran up to Sebastian at the folly.
"We should pack it in," he said. "That was too close." "One last pass!"
This final push produced a result. They located Julian, who had ambitiously gotten on top of a pergola and clung to the vines for hours in the rain. He might never have been found, except that he sneezed when Angela was walking underneath.
"Back to the castle," Sebastian yelled. "Official time out. Drinkies, gather the troops."
The call echoed out around the grounds, through the rain, and one by one the nine returned to the house, dripping wet and with a tremendous thirst. They knocked their way through the dark house by torchlight, laughing and falling. Sebastian produced some candles and lit them. and Peter stoked the fire and added more logs. The sitting room felt smaller with the cloak of darkness over it.
"Where are Rosie and Noel?"
Theo asked.
"Didn't they come in?"
The names Rosie and Noel were yelled in the direction of the stairs and out the front door, but there was no reply.
"Seems they are committed to the game,"
Sebastian said.
"Admirable."
"I think they're committed to something," Suze replied. "Maybe not the game."
"Don't diminish their achievement. Now, I know what we need."
Sebastian dropped to the floor and began crawling toward the dark side of the room. He started this trip holding a candle, but Yash plucked it from his hand as he went past.
"What are you doing?" Angela said.
"The good stuff is down here, the whiskey. Not just any whiskey, the 1936. We must have it."
Sebastian continued his creep across the floor until his head made contact with a cabinet against the wall. He rolled onto his back and jammed his hand down the front of his trousers to retrieve the keys, writhing like an inverted insect trying to gain purchase and right itself.
"I think I just witnessed the end of the family line,"
Yash said, wincing as Sebastian triumphantly yanked the keys from his waistband. He jangled the keys and began stabbing at the wooden door of the cabinet in an attempt to find the lock.
"We don't need it," Theo said.
"How dare you," he said. "Where is your resolve? We didn't win the war with that kind of attitude."
Thud, thud, thud. Scrape.
"Let me bring you some light, mate,"
Yash said.
"I don't need light. I am an artist. Stay back."
Thud, thud, jangle, thud. The battle of the cabinet was now a performance, a struggle for the ages.
"Once more onto the breach,"
Sebastian cried, audibly scratching the wood.
"Dear friends, once more, or close up this cabinet with our English dead."
"And we've reached the misquoting Shakespeare part of the evening,"
Julian said.
"Silence! In peace there's something, something. But when the blast of empty glasses blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with something. What do we disguise fair nature with? A wig."
"He's really making a meal out of this,"
Yash commented. Even for him, this was a touch over the top, a sketch that went on longer than it should.
"And scene,"
Peter said, dropping to his knees and crawling over to Sebastian. Sebastian held out his hand dramatically to pull his friend in.
"And you, good yeoman,"
Sebastian replied,
"whose limbs were made in England, you come to help your king. A horse, my kingdom for a
bottle of whiskey," Peter replied, taking the keys from Sebastian's hand before he carved the cabinet to shreds. Sebastian face-planted and pretended to be dead as Peter worked through the keys and found the right one. As soon as the cabinet door opened, Sebastian popped back up.
"You are the light of the nation,"
he said to Peter.
"I'll see you're remembered on the honors list."
He plunged his arms into the cabinet, shoving bottles out of the way, causing them to violently clank together as he sought his prize.
"Ah,"
he said, sliding one toward himself.
"Here we go, the 1936, the most precious."
He kissed the bottle reverently.
"Should we at least wait for Rosie and Noel to open it?"
Theo asked.
"No, it will be waiting for them when they decide to come in."
Sebastian poured 9 glasses with great ceremony, muttering some kind of incantation as he did so. These were distributed to the 7 people in the sitting room.
"A toast,"
Sebastian said, raising his glass.
"To us, the most brilliant, talented, attractive and humble group of wastrels in all of Cambridge, perhaps even the world. May we always land the punchline, play the fool, embrace disaster, and love absurdly. I adore you all to the bottom of my black and cold heart, and my life would be nothing without you."
Angela audibly sniffed.
"You wrote that in advance,"
Yash said.
"Maybe I did," Now drink, you disgusting peasants.
Sebastian had not lied. The whiskey tasted of ancient fires in the highlands of Scotland. It rolled smoothly down the throat, sending a column of warmth up the bridge of the nose and into the third eye. It slipped into the blood like an eel, and in its thrall, all the legends were true. The morning would be bad, even the soon might be sticky, but the now was exceptional.
Oh, God,
Yash said.
I can't feel the palms of my hands. I only have fingers now, loose fingers.
Tell me more, Suze cooed. The group lost themselves for a moment in the warmth of the whiskey and the fire and the booming storm outside the window. After what could have been 5 minutes or several hours, Peter rose unsteadily to his feet.
I, he said formally, am going to be very sick. I may be some time.
Soon after, Angela also acknowledged defeat and decided to go to bed. Theo followed, first stopping in the kitchen to pour a few glasses of water for herself and her friends. This was Theo's way. After every night of hard drinking, she left a glass of water by her friends' bedsides. Sebastian, Julian, Yash, and Suze remained in the sitting room. The night was long now, and the dark crowded them. Sebastian put on blur. The three of them fell into a pleasant silence for a while, enjoying the fire and the blankets and the whiskey. Sebastian's head tipped back awkwardly in what was either sleep or a long consideration of the plasterwork on the ceiling.
Rosie and Noel have really committed to this, Yash finally said. What time is it, anyway?
Julian raised his hand in the direction of the fire to consult his watch.
3:30.
Anyone else notice they've been getting a bit close in the last week? Suze asked. I hope they're out there shagging away in the mud all night.
She glanced over at Julian, who looked unconcerned as he sipped his whiskey. Suze was not going to be ignored. Not after a night in the rain and the better part of 2 bottles of champagne and 1 of Scotland's finest whiskies.
You were all over that Canadian at the pub a week ago, Julian, she went on. You can't complain.
I'm not complaining,
Julian replied, looking up from under the thick curtain of lashes that shaded his eyes.
I didn't say a word.
What Canadian?
Yash said, but Suze did not appear to hear him.
Now that we're here, you know, now that we're leaving, we need to be honest, Suze went on. We need to resolve things. If anyone's got things to say, we need to say them.
I always have things to say, Sebastian said.
I mean important things.
What Canadian at the pub?
Yash asked again woozily.
Some Canadian at the Horse and Feathers, Suze said.
At this, Julian did look uncomfortable, and he stared down into his glass.
The Horse and Feathers?
Yash mumbled.
I met a Canadian girl at the Horse and Feathers.
It was the same girl, Suze said. Julian got in there before you showed up.
What? Oh, come on, mate. You got together with her on Saturday,
Julian cut in.
This was Friday. I wouldn't do that to you. You know that.
The room settled into an uncomfortable but familiar silence. To be one of the 9 was to live with the twitching underbelly of feeling, and dramatic pauses were common. Yash stood, wobbling a bit.
Right, well, I have to.
With that, he left the room, taking a slightly sinuous path that included a direct hit on a side table and the edge of the door. A minute later, the distant sounds of retching came into the room, echoing from one of the downstairs loos.
I can't believe you sometimes, Suze said after a while. Betraying Rosie and Yash in the same moment. A new achievement for you.
I didn't.
You did.
Julian got up and started walking around the edges of the room, running his hand along the books on the shelves. He cut the figure of a romantic poet in the flickering candlelight, with his sparkling eyes and beautifully furrowed brow. He was Lord Byron in a flannel shirt, oversized jeans, and shell necklace.
I didn't betray Yash,
he said.
He hadn't even spoken to her yet. You know I wouldn't do that.
And Rosie? Well, that's a given, isn't it? You certainly betrayed her. But that train is never late, is it?
Suze, are we going to do this forever? Can we do anything else? Is it always berate Julian o'clock?
Sebastian broke into a dramatic snooze and a sharp snort.
What's that?
He said.
I died just a moment there when you two were doing the thing you do where you yell at Julian for being Julian, and you, Julian, do the dramatic thing and try to get out of whatever you've done by being good-looking. You two, either shag each other or shut up. Make a choice. I don't care which you choose, but you have to choose one.
Suze made a disgruntled noise and went to the window facing the front of the house to get as far from Julian as the room allowed. From the loo in the hall, there was a final cluster of retching coughs and the flush of a toilet.
I'm fine,
Yash called weakly to no one. This was followed by the sound of him unevenly ascending the stairs, punctuated by one or two full-body falls. More silence after that. Julian kept his position on the far side of the room, and Suze was riveted to the window. Sebastian sighed.
Boring, he said. Suze, come back over. I'll tell you a terrible story I just heard.
Suze remained at the window, her focus fixed at something out on the lawn.
There's someone out there, she said. I just saw a torch flash. Did you give Rosie or Noel a torch?
No,
Sebastian said.
Torches are for seekers.
They must have found one because I just saw a torch flash by. They must still think we're hiding. I'll go get them.
She went out to the main hall and yelled to them from the front door, her theatrical voice pushing back against the storm.
Nothing, she said as she came back into the room. There's no way they didn't hear me just now. It seems like they don't want to come in.
Should we go out and get them?
Julian asked.
I mean, it's absolutely shitting out.
Let's leave them to whatever it is,
Sebastian cut in before any more discussion of Julian and Rosie resumed.
It's a violent night, but they have each other. Now, who's hungry? Fish fingers? Oven chips?
And so Rosie and Noel were briefly forgotten, superseded by some frozen fish dumped onto a baking tray and shoved into an unheated oven. The rain beat on against the windows and walls of Merryweather, as if to mock its name. Sebastian was right. It was a violent night. Just not in the way that he meant it. 3.
What did you all do this time?
Larry said as a greeting. Security Larry had been fired over the course of the events of last year, and then subsequently rehired after he trekked up the side of a mountain in a blizzard to help Stevie and some others who were stranded there. He was now at his traditional position by the front door of the Great House, at his desk with his tin mug of coffee. He regarded the four students before him with a resigned sigh, which was Larry's way of showing affection. "You know I don't answer questions like that without my lawyer," Stevie replied. "And they had pumpkin maple rolls left over from this morning." Janelle slid over the container. "What's the mood?" Stevie asked.
"She was humming when she came in."
"What does that usually mean?" Vi asked.
"Hard to say. Might be good, but one time she was humming after she saw someone on an electric scooter ride into Lake Champlain. You can go up."
Stevie let her gaze float up the grand staircase, to the balcony above, where Dr. Quinn was waiting in the lofty quiet. The Great House was at the heart of the Ellingham Academy campus. When Albert Ellingham constructed his school in the 1920s, he'd built himself a mansion right in the middle of it. It was an elegant monster, made of tons of imported hardwood, cut crystal, stained glass, and marble. It had been the scene of great tragedies, which were immortalized in a family portrait that hung at the landing. A surreal image of Albert, Iris, and their daughter Alice, as painted by Leonard Holmes Nair. There were no paintings of the more recent tragedy. Dr. Quinn had taken over the office formerly occupied by Dr. Call Me Charles Scott, the overly enthusiastic head of school who had left the position the year before. When this had been Charles's office, it had signs on the door that said things like, I reject your reality and substitute my own. Question everything and challenge me. The last of which was generally considered the most odious. They had, in fact, challenged him. It was no longer his office. Instead of the posters and the corkboard, the door had been restored to its original smoked glass panel, with delicate Art Nouveau swirls etched into it. There was a simple and elegant brass plate on the door that read, Dr. Jenny Quinn, Head of School. They stood in the dark of the hall, and Stevie gently rapped on the door.
Come,
said a voice from inside. Dr. Quinn was seated at her desk, her attention focused on her laptop. She wore actual fashion. Expensive, confusing things with lots of folds and extra material, and heels with red undersoles. She was the kind of person you would expect to see at a global summit, probably because she attended global summits sometimes. Her job as the head of Ellingham Academy was a bit simplistic for her, but it was a prestigious school with a massive endowment and excellent skiing right on the doorstep. She could jet off to New York City or Washington, D.C. if she was needed, and she had the summers to go around the world, negotiating treaties or wrestling alligators or whatever it was you did for fun if you were Dr. Jenny Quinn.
Sit,
she said, not looking up. This room had originally been Iris Ellingham's dressing room. It still had her dove gray silk paper on the walls. There was a hole in one of those walls that had been patched over to the best of the ability of the maintenance crew. But there were still tears in the paper, clear signs of where the wall had been punctured last December. These four students had been in the room when it happened. Had put the hole in the wall, in fact. When Dr. Scott had been in charge, the room had been full of sofas and Funko Pop figurines. That nonsense was gone. The only things that had been kept were the large, framed map of Ellingham Academy that hung between the windows, and the green marble clock on the mantel that was said to have belonged to Marie Antoinette. Dr. Quinn had her own bookcases installed, and a wooden desk that could house a family of four. Janelle, Vi, Nate, and Stevie planted themselves in the chairs arranged in a horseshoe and waited until Dr. Quinn finished typing. She looked up, removed her glasses, and regarded the students in front of her with the disappointed look of a hanging judge who'd been denied a rope.
So,
she said. Nate cleared his throat nervously, which was a mistake. It was important not to show fear in front of Dr. Quinn. Or was that Bears? Same difference. Dr. Quinn did what police detectives in interrogations do. She let the silence accumulate past the point of comfort. People can't help but feel it. It's human nature, and it's what sinks a lot of murderers. This was something Stevie knew from her compulsive viewing of interrogations on YouTube. I've sent you the spreadsheet, Janelle began, breaking the silence, about our proposed week of study abroad.
I've seen it. Dr. Quinn replied. I want to hear it from you in person. Tell me what it is you plan to do if you're allowed to go. Explain it to me.
The explain it to me didn't sound good. The first few days would be dedicated to cultural landmarks, Janelle continued. The Tower of London, the Houses of Parliament, the Victoria and Albert Museum, the National Gallery. If you look at page 3, you'll see I've compiled a list of supplemental reading that I'm... Dr. Quinn waved her hand, indicating that Janelle should stop talking.
You, she said, I'm not worried about. Let me hear from someone else.
Vi stepped up. I want to concentrate on the impact of colonialism, they said.
That's a broad remit, Dr. Quinn said.
I'm going to narrow it to the British Museum, Vi said. And the question of ownership of cultural artifacts.
What about you, Nate? Book stuff, he said. Writers. Can you be more specific? British Library. I'm going to... There are manuscripts there. I'm going to look at them, the originals. And there are literary tours.
Dr. Quinn leaned back in her chair and rolled her fountain pen between her thumb and forefinger for a moment.
And what about you, Stevie?
She asked.
This trip seems to be at the invitation of David Eastman. So I assume you have something significant planned and you're not just making up an excuse to take time off school to visit your boyfriend, or some other ill-advised reason.
Well, Stevie said, I was hoping to just... The museums, the...
She'd practiced. She had a whole list of places, justifications, full-bodied lies. But in the scorching rays of Dr. Quinn's stare, her mind had become a dry and barren place.
The?
Use your words, Stevie.
The specific role that England plays in media portrayals of crime. Mysteries. Why we like English mysteries. How English mysteries got to be a thing, especially during the period between World War I and World War II. Murder as a comfort activity. Reading about it, I mean.
That was jumbled, but she got all the main concepts in there.
I see. Well, you can understand why I'm a bit nervous to allow the four of you to travel as a group. Things tend to happen when you move as a unit.
It's not really our fault, Stevie said.
A case could be made.
This is an academic trip, Janelle said. I mean, it's also exciting. I want to see London. We all want to see London. We got an offer with a place to stay. This is the only way we can afford to do it. And because it's Thanksgiving week, we'd only be missing about 4 days. It's an opportunity we're not going to get again.
Smart. Well played. Janelle landed that last note with just the right tone of voice. More pen rolling. Silence, except for the clank of the heating starting up from some dark corner of the great house. Tick, tick, hiss.
All right, Dr. Quinn said. I understand this pitch you've put together is largely a ruse to get my approval. But it is a good opportunity. London is an amazing city. I'm giving this my tentative okay, but there are conditions. Once these plans are approved by your teachers, you will make a schedule and you will stick to it. You will stay together as a group. You will not deviate from the plan without permission from me. I have many, many contacts in London. My eyes and ears are everywhere. I will also be calling you. The calls will be at random times, and when I call, you pick up and show me where you are and what you are doing. Think of me as always being with you.
Stevie Bell had faced murders, run for her life, fallen from great heights, and in various other ways looked into the abyss. None of those things quite brought the dread of the thought of Dr. Quinn hauling herself to an airport, boarding a plane, and going to another country just to bring Stevie home because she'd screwed up. But she had her yes. June 24th, 1995. 8:30 a.m. Theodora Bailey peeled her head away from the pillow and looked at her watch. She rubbed her face hard. On one hand, she knew she should go back to sleep. She'd only crawled into bed 3 hours before. On the other hand, she knew trying to go back to sleep was useless. She was constitutionally unable to sleep past 6 in the morning, no matter what she had been up to the night before. So this 8:30 in the morning thing was decadent enough. When she started training in the hospital in a few months' time, she would frequently be sleepless, but she would still have to perform her duties. This was good training. She pushed herself out of the wonderfully comfortable bed, considered throwing up, let the moment pass, and got to her feet. Out of everyone in the group, she'd had the least to drink the night before, but that still meant 4 or 5 glasses of champagne. Or 6. Who knew? Sebastian refilled them before they were empty, so it could have been any amount. On top of that, there had been the whiskey. It felt like someone had pulled a woolly jumper over her thoughts. It appeared she had tried to change her clothes before going to sleep. She was at least wearing an oversized Prodigy t-shirt as a nod to pajamas. She pulled on some tracksuit bottoms she found on the floor next to her. When she had started Cambridge, her hair was natural and long. With each passing year, she'd taken inches off it. Doctors needed something easy to manage, that didn't get things in it. Like your friends sick when you assisted them to the loo after a long night.
It was now flat on top and close-cropped. As she ran her hand over it, she found that it harbored a leaf and some organic detritus from crawling under a yew border a few hours ago. She plucked these out. The damage could be much worse. They were lucky none of them had been struck by a falling branch during the storm. Or an entire tree, for that matter. She could handle a leaf or two. After a quick wee and a splash of her face, she made her way down the main staircase, taking care to step on the edges of the steps rather than the center. The center of the step always creaked more than the edge. Not that she was likely to disturb anyone in a house this size. Living packed together as they did in Cambridge, she was hardwired to step lightly and try not to wake her friends. She went to the kitchen, drank a full pint glass of water, and washed it down with a cup of instant coffee and some loose hobnobs she found on a plate. The kitchen had suffered a grave assault during the middle of the night feast. She soaked the oven trays with the carbonized remains of the burned fish fingers and chips. She threw wrappers in the garbage, swept the floor, and washed plates and mugs. Then she began the circuit to take stock of the wounded. Sebastian and Suze were still fast asleep on their sofas, so she padded back upstairs and made her way along the halls, peering inside bedrooms. Yash, Peter, and Angela were all in their bedrooms, in various stages of undress and in a variety of positions. Yash had burrowed under the blankets, with only a bit of his hair sticking out the top. Angela was face down on the bed, fully clothed. Peter was in his underwear, sleeping sideways across the bed, his head and feet dangling. It took a bit longer to find Julian. He had decided to sleep on a chaise longue in the library. She put a throw blanket over him. Wherever she looked, she could not find Rosie or Noel. Not in the bedrooms they had claimed, or the empty ones, or any of the other rooms inside the sprawling maze that was Merryweather. The more she looked, the more determined she became to find them. She opened cupboards, she looked in closets, she went into the pantry, the cellar, all the bathrooms and anterooms. This was strange, but not even remotely the strangest outcome of one of their parties. One time she'd found Sebastian asleep on the front doormat. He'd walked all the way home from the pub, gotten to the door, and curled up and gone to bed. Another time she found Suze in a shopping trolley in the back garden. If Rosie and Noel were tucked away in a folly or outbuilding, there was nothing much in that. Still, it bothered her. She liked to make certain that everyone was all right. Also, it could get a bit boring being the responsible one who was up hours before anyone else. Normally, she would let them sleep, but that was when they had all the time in the world. Now, time mattered. Every precious second of it. After this week, they went back to the house, boxed up their things, and broke away. Suze, Sebastian, Peter, Yash, and Angela were all going to London. Julian was going up north to work in law. Rosie was going back to Dublin, maybe, or perhaps to Manchester, she still wasn't sure. Noel was uncertain where he was going, but for now he was moving back to his home in East Anglia. Theo had a few years left in her medical studies at Cambridge and at various hospitals. It took years to become a cardiologist, and she would be doing them without the eight other pieces of herself. She puttered around a bit longer, then she decided it was time to do some gentle poking. They would be sad if she woke them and had no good reason for them to get out of bed. She would make bacon sandwiches for everyone. They would all sit up for a bacon sandwich. Everyone except for Rosie, the resident vegetarian. She would get some vegetarian sausages on toast. The smell of bacon lured Peter first. He came shuffling into the kitchen and sank into a chair. From his gait and expression, Theo could see that while he was awake, he was not sober yet.
"How are you so good?"
he asked. "Just Theo replied. "You look awful."
"Thanks."
He accepted the bacon sandwich and consumed it greedily, then reached for a second. Yash and Suze wandered in next, collapsing together on a small sofa by the windows. Theo distributed tea and bacon sandwiches to them, which they ate, but with slightly less gusto.
"I still can't believe it,"
Yash muttered, his mouth full of sandwich.
"I finally meet someone. I meet one person, and Julian had to get in there as well."
"Before you met her," Suze said reassuringly,
She clearly liked you much more.
I gave her our number and address. I lent her a pulp CD. She said she was going to listen to it and bring it back. I liked her.
Julian is an arse.
Suze leaned her head onto Yash's shoulder.
He is an arse,
Yash replied.
We all know Julian's an arse,
Peter said. But he didn't do anything wrong this time.
Aside from cheat on Rosie, Suze said.
The leopard doesn't change his spots. She had to have been used to that. You got used to it.
I never got used to it, Peter.
I'm just saying.
Rosie's smarter than I am anyway. I stood for it more than I should. Rosie didn't, or not as often. And I was just as bad as he was. I'm simply saying that Noel and Rosie are meant for each other, and I'm glad they're getting together. And Yash, my darling, don't worry about Julian and this Canadian girl.
She never did ring. She probably went home. I liked her. And she liked my idea for the sketch where we all had buckets on our heads but never acknowledged it.
Peter closed his eyes.
That sketch is not going to work, he said. It just needs some polish.
My God, you two, Suze said. No wonder you never get any. You can only pay attention for 10 seconds before you're thinking about writing sketches again. Weren't you heartbroken a moment ago?
There's probably a sketch on that, Yash said.
The toaster popped up, and Theo put the finishing touches on a few more sandwiches, which were loaded onto a plate. She put these on a tray, along with more cups of tea, and went to the sitting room with it. Suze, Peter, and Yash followed her like ducklings. Well, ducklings who wanted more tea and bacon sandwiches. As she set the tray down on a table, Sebastian was seized by a jolt of energy and propelled himself out of the armchair.
Right, he said. Right, what's happening now? What are we doing?
He drank the contents of the nearest glass, which had 2 fingers worth of brown liquid in it, and possibly a little cigarette ash.
I'll go and get Julian, Theo said. He's asleep in the library.
Angela drifted down the steps, shuffling along and rubbing her eyes. She swiped a bacon sandwich and sat on the rug to eat it. Theo returned with a bleary Julian, who was rubbing his blonde hair. Julian managed to look more beautiful when tousled and sleep-deprived.
Have you seen Noel and Rosie? Suze asked them.
I looked, Theo replied. I couldn't find them.
Sebastian rested his head on the marble of the mantel and groaned.
They're still at it, he said. Chester is coming in the afternoon. He has a delicate disposition. Catching 2 people in flagrante delicto might do him in.
You should go and find them, Suze said.
Why me?
It's your house. You're lord of the manor. It'll be your dead gardener, and we all need some of your special something to get through this morning.
You're going to make me go out there into the blinding sunlight.
He poked his finger toward the window and the gray morning it framed.
Because our friends are raging nymphomaniacs?
Come on, Theo said, handing him a cup of tea. Drink this. We'll go have a look together.
Sebastian sipped it and made a face.
My God, there's no alcohol in this. Are you trying to kill me?
Yes, Theo said. Drink your tea.
And some water. I am, he said, stifling a burp. The Honorable Sebastian Holt Carey, the future 6th Viscount Holt Carey, honor me.
Suze threw a discarded crisp bag at him. It landed on his shoulder.
I'll ignore that peasant, he said, because there are still some crisps in here. Fine, send me out to my death. Theo, you're with me. Let's make this terrible journey into the burning desert sun.
How many bottles do you think we got through last night? Theo asked as they made their way over the spongy grass.
The steely tint of the sky suggested that the torrential rain of the night before might soon be repeated.
Who can say? Probably 20 or so of the champagne. It would be embarrassing if we drank less than that, plus whatever else.
And your parents won't mind.
Who cares if they do? That's what the stuff is for, anyway. We don't leave Cambridge every day.
What do you think of Rosie and Noel? Theo asked.
Long time coming, like some other pairings I could mention.
He looked at Theo pointedly.
Don't, she said.
Yash has always liked you, and you've always liked him. Why are you waiting? This is the time to act.
We've talked about this, Sebastian. They passed through an archway in the garden wall and stepped into the driveway. The gravel crunched under their boots.
No, I ask, and you don't answer.
Because I still have training to finish, and... They came upon an overturned wheelbarrow and a bucket.
Chester usually keeps that locked away somewhere,
Sebastian said.
That's his favorite wheelbarrow. He's precious about it. I think he...
His words trailed off. They had reached the woodshed. The door hung open. The padlock was still locked, but someone had gotten around that by ripping the latch away from the wood.
Bugger,
he said, hurrying over.
Bugger? Burgled?
Theo said.
It's sodding hell looks like it. I don't think our lot actually tears the buildings open.
Sebastian stepped into the shed and reached for the light switch, but nothing came on. There was little in the woodshed to steal, unless you were in the market for wood, spiderwebs, or old broken tools. It contained only one thing of real value, and Sebastian was checking on that now. He grabbed for something by the side of the door, which turned out to be a long-handled axe. He went deeper into the shed and held the axe up over his head, reaching around with the blade end delicately until it found purchase on a small loop of rope. He pulled down on this, lowering a set of folding wooden stairs.
Everything's fine up here,
Sebastian said from his position halfway up the steps. Theo could see only his lower half. The rest of him was up in the crawl space above the shed floor.
They didn't get what they were after, if that's what they came for. Floor's soaked. The door must have been open most of the night. Seems like they went to a lot of effort for nothing. What?
Theo was staring at Sebastian with a strange intensity as he came down the stairs.
Your face, she said. What about it? You've cut yourself. You're bleeding, right side. I don't think so, he said, touching his cheek. How would I have done that?
He examined his fingers. They were streaked with blood. He touched his cheek again, feeling for a cut, but there was none there. The blood was coming from nowhere.
I'm not cut, he said. Where's this come from?
Then he noticed it. The thing on the floor, near the woodpile. At first he thought it was a log, but then he saw that this particular log seemed to be wearing a Wellington boot. It was a bare leg sticking out from a pile of wood. Theo had also seen the leg and was down on the floor, pulling wood off Rosie.
At the very least, she was pulling the wood off what remained of Rosie.
4. The departure was now scheduled for the Saturday before Thanksgiving. Her parents were at first saddened by the thought of Stevie not being home to argue with them over a medium-sized turkey and boxed stuffing. But when they heard that David was involved, everything changed. Stevie's parents loved David. They loved him in a way that was irritating and unnerving. They loved him because, A, they were the kind of people who felt that Stevie's having a boyfriend was a primary mission in life, and B, David was the son of their hero, who happened to be an incredibly toxic politician, now disgraced and temporarily off the radar, doing whatever it was that toxic politicians do while waiting for the public to forget about their mistakes. Public memory is surprisingly short when it comes to these things. Whatever the case, this worked in Stevie's favor. That hurdle was easily cleared. The others had their respective conversations with their families, and everyone was granted permission for this educational opportunity. They had an email from some dude at the American Embassy. And sometimes that is enough to make your week-long plan of tours and photo opportunities seem more legitimate than it is. She went to class. She did the readings, usually. She went to study parties in the yurt. She saw the leaves change to gold and red and finally to brown and fall off the trees. She ate maple syrup and pretended to be a functioning member of the student body. She was physically present. Her body showed up. Mentally, not so much. For weeks, she was flooded with the kind of excitement that borders on panic. Everything was new and fresh and alive. The air smelled sweeter. Her classes were more interesting. Math seemed relevant. The new students were sparkling citizens of humanity, and her established classmates close as family. The sheep loved her, and she loved them. Her thoughts circled one subject like water in a drain. A few days before their departure, Stevie decided she couldn't handle her questions alone, so it was time to go to the expert. Stevie knocked on Janelle's door. Janelle looked up from some physics homework, a TV show, and crocheting, all of which she was watching or doing at the same time, because she was Janelle. Stevie sat on the floor and picked at the wood for a moment, trying to find the words. "When we go to England," she said, "I don't get to see David that often, and I've been... because he's been gone, and I want to..." She knew the words, but was having trouble uttering them. "I think we... I..." "You want to have sex with David," Janelle said plainly. Stevie pointed at her, indicating that she had guessed correctly.
"How did you know?"
Janelle smiled in a way that suggested that Stevie was a beautiful tropical fish, so simple and so precious. "What's the question?" Janelle asked. "I'm kind of not an expert on the whole male anatomy thing, but I know the basics."
No. "What do I do? Not what do I do, but what do I do?
For it? I mean, to make it happen. To get ready? I just want to be ready in case..." "You mean contraception? Is that what you're asking?"
"No, I mean, like, I've got to wear something."
"Actually, you don't. That's kind of part of it."
"I mean something for before, like an outfit."
"Oh," Janelle nodded. Clothing choices, this was her wheelhouse. "Well, first thing, I'd say you have to feel comfortable. It's about what makes you feel sexy. What makes you feel sexy?"
"Are you seriously asking me that?" "Nothing."
"I mean, what do you feel like you look good in?"
Stevie cast her gaze around the room helplessly.
Hoodie?
Janelle leaned back against the bed. This was a challenge, and Janelle liked a challenge.
"There is no such thing as a sex hoodie," she said. "At least, there is probably not such a thing as a sex hoodie."
"Please stop saying sex hoodie.
What about underwear?"
"I own underwear," Stevie confirmed.
"Maybe you can get nice underwear?"
Stevie had considered this, but nice underwear was not for her. She got 3 packs of cotton briefs, usually in black. They were all stretched out, except for one pair that held onto its elastic for dear life. It was the magic pair, and Stevie saved it for special occasions, like when she might be bending over more than usual or the day her favorite podcast released a new episode. As for bras, half the time she forgot to wear one, and the other half of the time she wore the same sports bra she'd gotten on a clearance rack. So really, it was bra. Singular. Very stretched out. Had deodorant marks on it that were never coming off.
"Let's do a little online shopping," Janelle said, pulling up a browser window. "See what we can find."
Janelle motioned for Stevie to sit next to her and breezily started searching for lingerie. Like that was a thing anyone could just do. Like looking at store websites was free or something.
"Let's start high-end," Janelle said, going to a gauzy, soft-focused site full of people lounging on sofas in coordinated underwear in the dappled sunlight, looking smugly content. "Let's just get a sense of your bra style. What do you like?"
Stevie didn't know what there was to like or dislike.
Bras were a standard construction. 2 bumpy bits, 2 strappy things, and something to hold it all together.
"Push-up?" Janelle asked. "Half-cup? Lace?"
Stevie tapped her nails nervously on the floor.
"Let's start with something basic," Janelle said, clicking on one of the offerings. It was some kind of lace situation, black with a silver trim. There was a suggestion of a French maid costume about it, and it was $90. While Stevie had some money now, she didn't have endless money, and not $90 for a bra kind of money.
"That's basic," Stevie said.
"Black lace is pretty standard. It's $90. What's your price point?" Janelle said.
I don't know. I didn't think about it."
Everything was wrong with everything Janelle suggested. Pink was wrong, too bright. Janelle offered a plain black bra, which was too severe. Red was out of the question. There was a blue bra that she was almost okay with, until Stevie saw that it had different colored lace, which disqualified it at once. Janelle was delighted by a bright yellow set, but more for her than for Stevie, as yellow was her favorite color. White made Stevie feel like a sacrifice. A green one just confused her. She would turn into a plant.
"I don't think it's the color," Janelle finally said.
"You don't want a bra. Okay, we'll move on."
"We don't have to," Stevie said. "I think maybe I'll think about it."
She had thought about it over those weeks. She had purchased something. It was in her suitcase. And now it was on the plane with her. Stevie had ambitions for the flight, things she was going to read, homework she was going to do so she would be ahead for the week and would have less to worry about. She was going to be productive. What she actually did, when the plane took off into the night and the cabin lights dimmed, was go into a fugue state and stare blankly at the tiny screen in front of her. She poked her finger at the entertainment selection, because it was there, in her face. And her brain was so overloaded from the experience that she could almost hear it sizzling. She found Murder on the Orient Express on offer. She had seen this movie at least 10 times, which was why she put it on again. It would be overstating the case to say she watched it. It was in front of her. She was aware of its presence. Dinner came around and Stevie accepted the item described only as chicken. She became obsessed with a pack of salad dressing that refused to open, so she tried to tear it with her teeth. This worked too well, and as she ripped it open, the contents exploded down the front of her black hoodie, the one she had planned to wear for most days of the trip, and now forever tainted by the sex hoodie conversation, and a little into Nate's hair. Nate did not notice because he was reading something, and she didn't want to tell him. Eventually, the line of peachy sunrise brightened, and they passed over a channel of water. The land looked like a green patchwork quilt, great squares of it, rimmed with lines of hedges and trees and meandering motorways. Then they dipped down over what Stevie could clearly see was London. There was the Thames snaking along. The plane bumped twice as it touched the ground. She had already decided to swallow the cost of turning on her data. It went against her every budgetary instinct, but there was no way she was going to be without it. There was a series of texts from David waiting for her. David.
Did you take off?
David.
Are you flying the plane?
David.
I'm watching your plane. You're near Iceland. Wave at Iceland.
David.
Are you here yet?
She tried to respond, but her phone was slow in recognizing its new location, and there was a sudden rush to get bags and flee the aircraft, like it was about to be filled with poisonous gas. Stevie was caught in the hubbub, pulling her backpack out from under the seat in front of her, shaking crumbs from her lap and shuffling her way out. She looked at the remains of the flight, the carnage that the passengers had wreaked on the plane. Wrappers, crumpled blankets, empty Pringles cans, overturned plastic cups, discarded eye masks. It looked less like an international flight and more like a dull rager had taken place. The first impression Stevie had of England was a series of hallways and lines. The corridors of Heathrow Airport were endless, with people striding along or hustling down the moving walkways, past advertisements of people with their arms open wide, welcoming them. There were winding pathways to get to immigration, where they waited with hundreds of other people. She approached the end of the line with her squeaky new passport. She was sure for a moment a customs agent would open it, take one look at Stevie, and say, "No way, weirdo, not letting you in." Or maybe, "Are you the girl who solved those murders? Because I think I found a body in a suitcase." It turned out they didn't even need to speak to anyone. They were each shuffled into a little glass compartment, where they put their passport face down, then a creepy little computerized eye slid down and took their pictures. The compartment opened, and Stevie was unleashed into the United Kingdom. While they waited for their bags, she sent David a text saying they had landed. Stevie glared at her phone, waiting for a response. Nothing came, not even when they went through the strange barrier that wanted to know if you had anything to declare. If you didn't, you went through a green section, where she kept thinking someone was going to stop and check or at least ask something. But no one did. They seemed to take you at your word. She held her breath a little, hoping that David might be one of the people lined up just outside the arrival doors, the ones holding flowers and signs and balloons. She was the balloon now, deflating softly. There was no David waiting at the barrier, or over by the transportation desk, or the coffee place, or the ATM. As much as she didn't want to be seen with her salad dressing and her glowing red eyes, she wanted that moment to be real, the one where he was leaning over, waiting for her. There was, however, a man in a brown sweater with a clipboard that read, Jeanette Franklin, Nate Fisher, Vi Harper Tomo, Steve Bell.
I win, Nate said, dragging his suitcase. Steve! Jeanette and Vi and Steve!
The man who had a thick Cockney accent told them to follow. They did so through the arrivals area, up the elevator, out to a car park. They followed him for so long that Stevie started to wonder if they were the victims of a very lazy kidnapping. She had hoped for one of those big black cabs that looked like bowler hats, but it was a black minivan with the words Addison Lee written across the back window. Within minutes, they sped along down a highway, and as much as she had prepared herself for being on the other side of the road, it still messed with her senses for a few minutes. She watched the trucks, which were vaguely different in a way she couldn't place. There were also some sheep in the pastures along the road, so it was like they had taken a little bit of Ellingham with them. There was no sign that said, Welcome to London, population lots, plus we have ghosts, or anything like that. There were suddenly just more things. More houses along the road, more shops, more trucks and cars and overpasses. Then she saw the first double-decker red bus, and it all came into focus in her head. Red pillar post boxes, ornate street signs in white, red, and black, grander houses in brick with arched windows and wrought iron balconies. Endless buildings with a low, severe grandeur. Long rows of white-fronted buildings, Union Jack flags flapping in front of hotels, the distinctive tube signs with the red circle crossed through with a blue bar. Then she saw the first landmark she clearly recognized. The statue of Eros in Piccadilly Circus. They wound through streets of theaters and restaurants, down to a much faster road that followed the river. Then a series of turns past a massive gray stone building that looked like a palace. A few more turns around a confusing block. Then the car came to a stop in front of a building made of red gold brick. They really liked bricks in London, with long windows. It was 5 stories high, with multiple peaks and arched windows. Next to it was an identical building, and the two were connected by a lower structure.
Here we go, said the driver.
Early in the drive, Stevie had been texting updates to David. She had been too entranced to do so for the last half hour, and only now looked down at her phone to see a message.
David. Sorry, something has come up. I'll try to see you tonight.
Her eyes almost filled with tears.
What? Vi said.
Stevie held out the message for them to read.
It's fine, Vi said. We'll unpack and then you'll see him.
I'll try to see you tonight. What the actual hell? Nate leaned over and read the message as well.
Oh, good, he said. I was hoping for some weird tension.
Come on, Janelle said, opening the door. We're here. Stevie took a gulping breath and opened the door on her side, almost knocking into someone on a bike. She heard a shouted swear word as the bike moved on.
Look to your right, said a voice.
A head appeared in the open doorway. It came in from the side, almost upside down. There was a shock of near-black hair, a shag of half-curls and wisps, a twisted smile.
How's it going, jerks?
5. David extended a hand to help her out of the car.
You! A joke. You love jokes.
I hate jokes, she replied, breaking into a smile. His hand was warm and the gesture so genteel. This was the first touch, the first contact. He was real.
Oh, that's right, he said.
And then he swept down and kissed her. It was fleeting. Truly, it was just a brush of the lips, Now that he was standing upright and she was in front of him, everything shifted into position. She had looked at him in hundreds of photos since he'd been in England, and over equally as many video calls. But in person, she could see how his slightly longer hair moved in the breeze, the tips of the curls snapping back and forth. He was wearing his fine, long black dress coat. The coat. It had apparently caused a $2,000 dent in his father's credit card. He'd bought it to impress her, to dress up for her, and probably to piss off his dad as well. In both these things, it had succeeded. It was hard to explain the effect it had. It swept the backs of his calves. The lapels seemed to draw out the angles of his face. It was a magical piece of clothing. Under it, he wore the worn-out Yale sweatpants that had belonged to his father, the white letters crusted and crumbling along his leg. She took a step closer and noticed an unfamiliar smell. New detergent. A strong scent. This was his English scent. She wanted to grab him, to push him flat against the side of the minivan, to kiss him until her lungs turned inside out from lack of air, until night fell and the sun rose again. She wanted to discuss the world and not care. She wanted vengeance on months of lonely nights. She wanted to taste his skin. What she said was, "You suck." He threw his arms around her waist and picked her up, spinning her once, almost hitting the driver with her legs. The driver dodged around, making a low grumble, and went to haul their suitcases out of the back of the car. David greeted them all. Vi and David had always gotten along well, so a warm hug was exchanged. Janelle had never been as fond, but she accepted a hug. Nate was simply not a hugger, so they nodded to each other. Stevie had been gripping a 10-pound note in a sweaty hand for the last half hour of the trip, and she presented it to the driver before he left. She was unsure from his look whether this was a lot or a shameful pittance. She decided she would worry about this for days. It would wake her up at night.
"Welcome to London," David said. "This is Craven House, where you'll be staying. That building," he pointed to an identical building to the one that they stood in front of, "is where I live. It's connected to this one through this lobby and the common room. You live this way."
He grabbed the closest suitcase and started pulling it along. It happened to be Nate's. Nate was perfectly content with having David do his lifting. There is no elegant way to drag your suitcase up some steps and into a lobby with too many fluorescent lights, which Stevie was certain turned her skin a fetching shade of grayish-green, like a sad cabbage. It was still late November, but a small Christmas tree was up in an empty corner of the lobby, looking like it was at a party at a stranger's house and hating every minute of it. At the front desk, their photos were taken and printed onto ID cards. Stevie tried not to look at hers, with her bloodshot eyes and salad dressing hoodie. Each of them was handed a key on a plain ring.
"Room 519, the person behind the counter said to Stevie. "Fifth floor."
There were elevators, but they were hilariously small, clearly designed to aid people who needed it and not to carry stupid American suitcases up five flights. They pressed into the elevator in two loads of people and bags, and it made the begrudgingly slow ascent to their floor.
"This way," David said, grabbing the handle of Stevie's suitcase and pulling it along.
To get to their rooms, they had to pass through three separate heavy doors that segmented the hallway for no clear reason.
"Someone's in the pocket of Big Door," Nate said.
"They love fire doors here," David said. "Something to do with the whole city burning down."
Most of the doors along the hall were closed, and there was only a faint sound of voices behind some of them.
"Seems empty," she said.
"Well, it's the pub hour. A lot of people go down for drinks or food or to hang out in the lounge around now. There's kind of a routine. I'll show you. This one's yours, Vi. Nate, here you are. Janelle, I think you're down a few doors. And here, 19.
Stevie opened the door of a compact, utilitarian room with front-facing windows that looked out over the street. Unlike Ellingham, which had big, quirky rooms, this room was a modern blank canvas. Plain white walls, empty corkboards, built-in lights overhead and next to the bed. David half-closed the door and embraced Stevie, looking down into her face.
"You actually came," he said.
"Wait, were you joking about the invitation?"
"Yeah,"
he said.
Can you go back?
All the time and distance that they'd been apart fell away, and Stevie was full. Full of love and feeling, not just for David, but for everything. The built-in wardrobe, the slightly crooked window blind, the reusable plastic water bottle with the school logo. Taking in the general vibe.
I was only sort of joking about being busy, David said. I have a lecture I have to go to. I'll be back in about 2 hours. You guys can get settled, and then I'll meet you back here at 4. I'll take you guys over to the local, and then I have a surprise.
What?
A surprise surprise. The kind where you don't know what it is.
The local, Stevie clarified. What's the local?
That's what they call the pub. Your pub is your local, and we have a local. And you have to go, it's the law.
Then he took her face in his hands and kissed her. It wasn't designed to be a long kiss, since he had to go, but it was also the kind of kiss meant to make up for time already lost. A strong kiss, one that made solid contact and held it and seemed to ask, "Are you really here?" She grabbed him around the back of the neck, pressing him harder into her. She forgot how you could hear the other person breathe, feel the warm exhale, know that they were alive, that they wanted to be with you so much